NBC Sports. It is Pierre Maguire. Good morning, Pierre. How are you?
Steve, you liked it so much, you came back pretty quick. Good morning to you. Hello, Sean.
Morning, Pierre.
Well, it was a grueling two-day work week for JR, so we needed another week, okay? That's what he needed to do. I'm more than happy to do it. Love talking hockey with you, Pierre. So we'll get to the World Junior stuff in just a moment. It's Monday, and we're all wondering, are you hearing anything? Is this the week we get something definitive from the NHL and the NHLPA as to when a season will be beginning?
I'm going to be cautious on this. One of the things that makes me very cautious is the fact that we're not hearing anything from any general managers. There's been a cone of silence. The only people you're getting any kind of information from are either people from the league office, Bill Daly or Gabe Bettman, or people from the PA. And we're not hearing anything from owners, really, outside of Mr. Melnyk's comments last week that started the week, I think, with a ripple effect, positive more so than negative. And that's it. So when that happens, my experience has been over time that when managers are cut out of the loop, and it seems like they are right now, things are probably not trending in the right direction. So I think there's a lot of work to do before this thing gets settled. When you don't have any leaks at all coming from management level type people and you don't see any, they've probably been cut out of the process.
Pierre, does this in the last week feel more like a lockout now versus necessarily a whatever COVID-19 alert?
I don't want to say that because I think that's too strong, but I totally see your point on it, Sean. That's why I said what I just said.
Yeah.
The cone of silence is up, and that usually means there's significant negotiation going on at one level or another, probably at the highest level. There might be some back-channel negotiation. But again, for over time, my experience has been when certain parties have been cut out of it, and you could probably call any of the 31 GMs in the league, not counting Ronnie Francis, who's obviously not really involved at this point, but if you were to call any of the other 31 managers, I think most of them would say, I have no idea what's happening. And that tells me, again, this is at an ownership level, this is at a board of governor level at the highest end, and probably at a presidency level. So that tells me that there's a lot of room for negotiation here.
From your vantage point, Pierre, is there an obvious angle for some wiggle room on negotiation? Because it all comes down to money, as it always does, right? Whether it's going to be escrow, whether it's going to be deferred money. Is there a solution as you look at it?
Yeah, the owners are going to have to wrap their head around the fact that if they want to play hockey, they're going to have to do it and take significant losses because you're not going to get fans back in the building. So That's the thing that's been going on, and I've been telling, you know, JR and Sean about it since the third week of, the pub in Edmonton where I was. I was hearing it from people then, 3 weeks into it, that we were going to have a really difficult time because of the financial losses that were being accumulated by ownership groups around the league during the bubble, and it proved out to be correct. So that's the issue, Steve, is I feel terrible for the players, first of all, because they signed a good conscience, a longstanding agreement, 6 years extension on a collective bargaining agreement. They put the work in. They made sacrifices. They played by the rules. They were part of escrow, and they've paid into their escrow. And I respect the players. I think what the players did last summer was phenomenal. Not a little bit good, off the charts good. And I also understand, and this is where it gets a little bit dicey and slippery, I also understand the point of view of ownership. If you can't get people into the building, you can't have a functioning business. And, you know, I'll give you an example. Last week, the Tampa Bay Lightning laid off 30 people. I can tell you from my heart of hearts, no way would Jeffrey Vinnick ever in a million years want to lay off anybody, anybody. He's just that type of a human being. He has no choice. His business people are telling him, here's the problem. This is where we are. So I'm not blaming the players. I'm not blaming the owners. This is a really hard conundrum to figure out. This is an amazingly difficult situation for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, it's losses for the owners, just how much they want to accept here. Back to your point on the managers, though, this has also been a trend in the league for a long time where the managers, quite simply, in a lot of things outside of hockey operations, are no longer involved at the league level, right?
No, that's true. That's fair. But usually you'll have older managers, meaning experienced managers, whose owners really respect and appreciate them. The owners will bring them into the loop and share information with them. And more times than not, those managers will share that information. It's like a little club. It is a little club. There are very few of these jobs. And so that information will get shared amongst their peer group, and then eventually it'll find its way out. You're not seeing any of that. How long have we been, you know, gone from the bubble in Edmonton since the last week of September? You haven't seen any manager saying anything about when we're going to return to play. It's just they have no idea. So what I'm saying is they've basically been cut out of this decision-making process because it's an ownership situation that the owners are going to have to deal with along with Gary Bettman.
As we all look for tea leaves, can we read anything into the fact that some players have started to end their loans overseas? I see Kotkaniemi is going to be done, and presumably to prepare to come back to North America. Do you read anything into that, that that's starting to happen, Pierre?
Well, I think some of it's starting to happen. Again, you talk to agents as well, and agents are hopeful because without playing, they don't get paid. So they need the players back playing too. And so I think they're wistfully and hopefully thinking that they can get their guys back in, and then once they get back in, then camps can start, and then everybody can get going. But we'll see. I mean, you know, again, Kotkaniemi won't have if we don't have NHL. I'm not saying we won't. I'm just using this as a you know, something that people can look at. If we're not to have NHL hockey this year, he could still go back home and play. That's not going to be an issue for him. There are other guys that won't be as lucky. So, do I think we'll have NHL hockey? Yes, I do. When we'll have it, I don't know. But I would think that players are getting antsy right now.
Yeah, I think everybody is. And to that, Pierre, it continues to be discussed, but is it almost an automatic for where the climate is at that we will end up seeing an all-Canadian division?
Oh, no, though. If there's hockey, then I believe there will be. There'll be an all-Canadian division. Again, that's something we talked about going back to Edmonton. And people are like, really? You think that'll happen? I'm like, yeah, that's going to happen because of the border. The border's closed. And you know, that's pretty significant. You know, you've traveled back and forth so many times over the course of your scouting career and management career. You know how important it is to get across the border and have to work in either the United States or in Canada. That's just the reality of the hockey business. This is the way we're built.
All right, let's move on to a little World Junior Selection Camp talk here. Dylan Cousins looks like he got a little bit nicked up, something to keep an eye on. Had the scrimmage last night, and maybe we'll start to have the first cuts tomorrow. Now, this is a unique camp. It's so long, and we discussed this in our time together last week as well. You know, how difficult, and, you know, Fair's got nothing to do with it. I get that. But there's some guys that are still in quarantine from the NCAA that haven't had a chance to really show themselves. There are some players that have had COVID, Ridley Gregg, and haven't had a chance here. So it's not fair, but you can't keep these numbers forever, and it looks like cuts are coming.
Yeah, I think they'll make the cuts. They won't make a ton of mistakes. The ones that will bother me, if they are done, will be the political ones. And we'll see. It's too early to say how much politics will play in this. I think for some of the players that have been invited, it's realistic that they probably know they're not going to have a long shelf life through this process. It's just the way it works. And, you know, again, we'll see how it plays out. But I wouldn't prejudge anything. But I just tell you this, Canada's going to be really good. They're not going to be a little bit good. They're going to be really, really good. And, you know, I'm keeping my antenna up like everybody else, just watching and trying to evaluate.
If they make cuts this week and get down to 32, Pierre, they've got a couple of preliminary games around the 21st of December. That span of, 3.5 weeks, does that seem a little bit long for that group, or do you like those numbers?
No, it's long. I talked to a bunch of NHL decision makers, and they would never do that, you know, with their groups to have that long camp with that many people. So, no, it's really difficult. But, again, this is a unique time. There's no perfect solution. I think they're trying to get it right. There's a lot of pressure, obviously, because it's being played on home soil. There's just such a level of professionalism with Hockey Canada and this event in particular. They don't want to drop the ball. So it's everybody's going to have their own opinion, but I think more times than not, you got to give Hockey Canada the benefit of the doubt. They do it right so many times compared to how many times they do it wrong. They do it right far more than they do it wrong.
Pierre, Simmer brought this up last hour. Do you get the sense, as we develop goaltenders in this country, and it's no disrespect to the five that are at this camp, but you know there's not that scouting star power level, but it's not like we've seen that all the time. There are many examples of goaltenders having fantastic tournaments that kind of came out of nowhere. Is that just one of those things? What do you account for development of young Canadian goaltenders? Because it seems like recently it's Carter Hart and just a lot of other guys.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. For whatever reason, it's been a little bit shallow in terms of talent pool. I don't know if that's cyclical or not. You know, I'm party to the Brodeur situation and how he came along. You know, you watch a player like Carey Price. I mean, there's a big difference from when Carey Price got drafted in 05 and Marty Brodeur got drafted in 90. You know, Trevor Kidd was in the same draft with Brodeur. So it's different. I mean, Sean's a goalie. He could probably speak to it better than I could. But I would just say I think the goaltending thing is more cyclical than anything else.
Yeah, I ask you, Pierre, I think it's dried up. And my only summary I can kind of look at is that for whatever reason, well, I don't know how much of our population is 6'4". At the end of the day, these Finnish, Swedish, and Russian kids and some others coming over, they're just quite simply, in my estimation, better athletes than the kids that want to play goal here in Canada.
Because what's happened, well, in their country, it's not as prominent as maybe in North America and in Canada and the United States, obviously, North America. But they're better athletes that are big are playing hockey because it's a vehicle for them. Better athletes can play baseball. They can play basketball. They can play football. A lot of those goaltenders that you're talking about, and I'll use Vasilevsky as an example, if you were to walk in to an NFL dressing room and just hang out with the tight ends, and all of a sudden you invite Vasilevsky in, he might be as big or bigger than most of the tight ends in the National Football League. If you were to bring in any of the top tall, and I mean big goalies in the league, it would be very much the same. The reason I bring up Vasilevsky's name, I'll never forget being at the All-Star game in San Jose a couple of years ago, and Vasilevsky sitting next to Henrik Lundqvist. And Lundqvist, who had played against them, had never seen him in street clothes or in his, you know, workout clothes. And he looks at me and goes, I can't believe how big this guy is. Like, even for a hockey player, and big now, this guy is just so much bigger. You're like, whoa, this is freaky. But that's where it is. And I think that's part of what Sean's talking about, Steve, is that a lot of those countries, that, you know, whether it's Finland, Sweden, or Russia, their better athletes go right into hockey, especially their bigger guys.
Well, and to the size point as well. So Craig Button filed a report from the camp last night. In his opinion, Brett Brochu is kind of pulled ahead at this stage here. Long way to go. He's the only goaltender there listed at under 6 foot. He's listed at 5'11". So I went back to the NHL for the past season. There are only three goaltenders in the entire league last year, Pierre, that were listed under 6 foot, and one of them played in the Stanley Cup final, and Anton Hudobin, and you're looking at Saros, and you're looking at Halak, and that's it. Are we ever going to see goaltenders, of a smaller stature make a bit of a comeback in terms of being evaluated to potentially play in the NHL, or is it just a big man's position now?
You're going to have to ask Manny Legacy. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
No, but it's going to be tougher and tougher for smaller guys to get in and play. There's no question. Just because of, I think one of the things that helped change us a lot for the size of the goalies, and this was talked about in 05 when the rule changes went into place, the stretch pass, the zero tolerance and obstruction, and the inability of defenders to put their sticks parallel to the ice to defend against the opposition. You put those three things in, it allows players to have more time and space to shoot pucks and elevate pucks. And when you can elevate a puck in shorter time, which they can with these new sticks, it makes it tougher for smaller goalies because if the smaller goalie drops, you're going to get high by the ears quite often. So those are three of the, I think, three and even four because of the new sticks that have made it really difficult for smaller goalies to survive.
Pierre, I see big pitcher Johnny Gardner, the longtime coach at Avon Old Farm, setting some records.
Unbelievable. John Gardner's been at Avon Old Farm since the mid-1980s. He got his 800th win this weekend against Salisbury School, which is an elite school, develops tons of players over time. And I've known John ever since he started at Avon, and I'm blown away by the fact that he got his 800th win. The only man in prep school hockey that's close to him is Kenny Martin at Belmont Hill, who has 707 career wins. And a person like John Gardner's been doing this selflessly for so many years, and he could have left a million times to go to really good college jobs. But I'll give you a laundry list of some of the players that he's coached over time. Jonathan Quick, Nick Bonino, Cam Atkinson, Patrick Harper, who's about to turn pro. He's at Boston University right now, won a World Junior goal with Team USA. Christopher Higgins, Nick Dimitrakos, who played in San Jose. But the best player he ever coached there was Brian Leetch. The best player he ever coached was Brian Leetch. And Brian would tell you over time just how much John meant to his career, especially early on with the Rangers. So what an amazing achievement. 800 wins in prep school hockey is amazing when you consider back in the day when they first started, they were probably only playing 25 games. Now they play 30. You know, you start doing the math. That's an amazing, amazing record. So congratulations to Coach Gardner and Avon Old Farms. The Winged Beavers, Sean. That's their name.
Yeah, I remember, well, Brian Leach was the first one coming out of there, played against him in the World Junior. Also to that, Pierre, just bigger picture. It's been really nice with Quinnipiac and Yale. My buddy Keith Elaine, the longtime coach there. We have really seen some growth through the Connecticut, New York, over to Long Island area of actual players going to the National Hockey League.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, you're going to see Trevor Zegras play with Anaheim. You're going to see Spencer Knight play with Florida at some point. Those are Connecticut kids. The Connecticut development programs have been phenomenal. Quinnipiac and Yale have helped. Sacred Heart is a real sleeper team in Division One. Nobody talks about them enough. And Mike Cavanaugh is a coach at the University of Connecticut. Sean, he has done, and he, for all those years, he built those Boston College teams for Jerry York that won national championships. He's a head coach at UConn now, and he's putting his...
Have they finally gotten an indoor rink?
They have one, but not the one, not the one they want. Not the one they want. They yeah. have one, but they still play their game, their bigger games, whether it's against BU and BC. They're in Hockey's and UMass Amherst. They play at the old Hartford Civic.
Trivia for the listeners. Who's the most famous UConn ice hockey alumni?
Todd Krieger.
Exactly.
And
he had the wheels story? Back in the day. Great guy.
Oh, did he ever. Best bow-legged skater I saw since Gilbert Perreault.
No, he was, but, for sure.
So let me just give you a quick story on that one. And if Roy Malark is listening, he can back me up on this. I was coaching at Babson College, and Roy was a general manager of the New Haven Nighthawks. And they were going into a playoff series. And New Haven at the time was being run by L.A. So Roy was working for them. And Roy called us up because we had just eliminated UConn in a playoff series. And he said, who are the best players in Division II, III that you know of? And I said, well, the best kid I've seen is a kid that plays for me, Tommy Sasso, but he's been drafted by Quebec. The next best player is Todd Krieger, and I think he'll play in the NHL. So they brought Todd Krieger, I'm not kidding you, from UConn, which is in Storrs, Connecticut, down to New Haven. That's about an hour ride. He played in that playoff game. And then I think there was a team by the name of the Washington Capitals that signed him. But that's how Krieger got his opportunity in pro hockey. His first games were played with the New Haven Nighthawks.
Yeah.
And because we had knocked him out in a playoff series.
Yeah. Egan Wheel. I think Krieger started out in Hartford, Pierre. And then we ended up bringing him to Washington. Yeah. Like, we brought all the Hartford players back. And also, would you agree that New Haven with 3,000 fans was one of the loudest buildings and maybe some of the ugliest people you've ever seen?
Oh, my
no,
goodness.
No, I'm not going to do that. But you know what, Stevie? Just
that good morning.
No longer, that building's no longer there.
Oh, man.
It used to be right by 95.
Oh.
You pull in there and the parking lot, Stevie, was underneath the rink.
No. Well, the original parking lot, Pierre, was on the roof and was condemned the night they opened building because it was too heavy.
It was. When you go in there, it was everything you thought a minor league rink would be. It was dark. It was dingy. There was cigarette smoke all over the place. It was rough.
I remember going there, Pierre, because we heard about Yale growing up, and we took the bus in from Baltimore. We used to stay at the Howard Johnson right on 95
everybody,
there.
No, but everybody
it was bad. And then the rink was so loud, and as typical to me, I was usually the backup goaltender, and they'd be giving it to me the whole game. The trick that they would do is that I'd be sitting there. They'd take ice out of their drink. And they would whip it, and it would hit off the glass just on the side. If it didn't scare the bejesus out of me, and you jump up and you look over, and there they are. But that was really the transition of the old school. That was where the American League was just starting to get younger, but you still had a lot of the old school veteran players.
It was that was a rough town. There's no question. And you know what, Yale. When you go to Yale, and whether you coach there, or play there, or go to school there. It's almost like an oasis in the middle of the city. They're trying their best to really clean up New Haven, and I think they've done a pretty successful job of it, but it's still got some work to do.
All right, there was minor league story time. I love it. More of that to come here, hopefully, throughout the week. Pierre, always appreciate the visit, and we'll do it again tomorrow.
Oh, awesome visiting with you, Steve. Take care. Be safe, everybody.
Hey, Pierre. Also on that team was Mr. Couturier, where we used to hang out with Sylvain, Mario Gosselin, and Craig Duncanson. And that New Haven team, I'd say pound for pound, some of the best beer drinkers in all of pro sports.
that's very strong.
Where has time gone, hey?
Oh, man. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Yeah.